Well, rather than thank the organizers for inviting me, I think I'll chastise Maria for sticking me at the end. So this is a monster session. One thing I realized is when you're last, pretty much everybody before you says every single thing that you wanted to say. So I probably will talk a little more extemporaneously up here, and the slides will be sort of background visual. But Maria wanted asked me to talk about our approaches to actually our successes with transgenic plants, and I think success may be a relative term. But I'm going to talk a little bit more about our approaches, and I think from what I've seen, a lot of the things that we do, which may speak to our level of success or lack thereof, is a little bit backwards. So we, my lab tends to take a field-based approach and then sort of deconstruct everything and work backwards, and we do some greenhouse stuff, but we're really rooted in the field. Maybe, again, if there are any burgeoning or young graduate students or postdocs, they can use some of what I'm saying in their own work. So more than a couple of years ago, I was fortunate enough to take Henry's plant breeding class, and I was excited, and I thought, man, Henry's the man. He's going to come in here, and he's just going to lay this all out, and it's going to be great. And the first thing he said, you know, there were probably five of us in the class, is how sorry he felt for us, because they'd already done all the easy stuff in plant biology, and now it was time to dig in and do the hard stuff. And I think this point was actually made. I don't think he actually meant that he was doing a lot of the easy stuff had been done. It's just that a lot of the work previously, this is a yield curve, a yield response to water curve. Well, clearly, it's just a cartoon of one. But we all know this. The more water you add, either rainfall or irrigation, you tend to get this very rapid response and yield. But I think what Henry was alluding to is a lot of the work, a lot of the past work had been done up on this part of the curve, where your margin for error is very large. You apply more water, for the most part, you get a little bit more yield. But if you're off on your estimates or how you're monitoring your crop and what the crop actually needs, your margin for error in terms of a yield penalty is fairly small. Unfortunately, we're now working in this part of the curve, where your margin of error is incredibly small. So if you're off in terms of estimating what the crop needs or looking at things like crop developmental response and trying to predict yield, if you're off there, the penalty for that is substantial. And anyone that has a colleague in Texas or is from Texas, one of the points that I got this slide from James Mahan, he's in the back, one of the points he just made is we've just gone through several talks and, you know, how complex is drought stress? Well, we went through a couple of hours of talks, and no single person has quantified drought stress, right? So you can give it, I work in temperature stress too, and that's easy. Hey, we expose these plants to 40 degrees or to minus 10 or whatever, but no one has quantified drought stress, and I think that speaks to the complexity of the stress itself. So my lab has basically taken, again, sort of, I think, maybe what could be a backwards approach in looking at genomics and taking a gene expression approach or an omics approach and sort of asking whether or not we can use omics data, use omics approaches to improve traits. And one of the big problems, as a second point, is really integrating or scaling up sort of systems-level approaches onto a field scale. And then I think a lot of this has been addressed today. What do we target? Root physiology or root morphology, flowering time, very specific traits like cotton fiber quality or flavor attributes in peanuts. And again, I think Eric referred to this, and Henry did as well. is what type of germplasm is available. So one of the things that we've done is gone back and looked at germplasm diversity and asked questions about how really diverse sets of germplasm respond to environmental stress, and then sort of tried to apply some genomics approaches to that problem. So my lab sort of hedges its bets. Again, there's been some mention of cropping systems and management and how important that actually is. So my lab is actually split between germplasm improvement and crop management. So we're very interested in current and what we predict to be future production management schemes. So minimal till, scheduled deficit irrigations, and things like that. And again, the point was made earlier, it doesn't do you any good to develop technology for a production scenario that exists in, you know, 1% of the marketplace, if that's your target. And again, so this is our scaling issue. This is our greenhouse. This is our field. And this is a center pivot irrigation. So if you're flying into most cities in Texas, you'll see these in most years green circles. This year they were all brown because of the drought we had. But basically, this is our production environment. So this is a thermal image of 130 hectare circle where we've been running some peanut and cotton irrigation trials. And basically what this shows is blue is a cool crop canopy, and as it progresses towards red or orange, that's a warm crop canopy. And one of the things you notice that in addition to the incredible amount of variation in the field, so here's the pivot arm. This section of the field has just been irrigated. This is 2 days after an irrigation event, 3, 4, 5, and so on. This is 1 week after irrigation. Is in addition to a large amount of variability you see in an average size field, the other thing that we know, if you're talking about production, agriculture, is plants are constantly put through this cycle of optimal conditions and suboptimal conditions, at least when it comes to water and temperature. And so one of the things we're interested in this approach to germplasm improvement or identifying genetic material is we're looking at responses in terms of acclimation or environmental plasticity. So rather than take maybe a traditional approach and look at things that, oh, these genes are upregulated in response to water deficit under these conditions, we're really interested in how plants respond to this continuous cycling of elevated temperature and declining soil moisture or declining plant water stratus. So without, again, putting a number, I'll try to put a number on drought stress. What is drought stress? Our production environment received 6 millimeters of rainfall this year from October 2010 to August 2011. We had 90 consecutive days of over 90 degree temperature, and we had more than 60 days of over 100 degrees. So there's a number to put on drought stress. So these guys that farm in our region are, I call them sort of, it's sort of the X Games of farming. So we're running short, and I know people want to grab a beer or something. But we're looking at, again, this acclimation capacity, and we're asking questions are, if we have scheduled deficits in combination with different management techniques, how does that affect yield? This is an experiment we ran for a couple of years on that pivot where we let the farmer set his irrigation, and then we set some acclimation strategies where we cut back water early in the season, cut it back early and late in the season, based on, again, farmer recommendation and estimated ET. And again, what we see is, again, this plasticity of the plants, the ability of these plants to acclimate to water deficit stress without a big penalty in yield. And then we're asking, cut through the economics, basic questions. Okay, in these acclimated trials, in these scheduled deficits, what is the plant doing? What do they look like? How does leaf area change? How does root morphology change? So we use mini rhizotrons, and we look at root responses. And so this is the beginning of the experiment, and what you see down the side here, this is soil depth, this is rooting depth, and then this is width, and then we've just basically applied a heat map to look at the number of roots at depth and lateral root growth. So this is mid-season. These plants at this point, the 50% treatment was actually an early season deficit where we managed water, we cut back on water for the first about 40 days of the growing season, and then asked, how are the roots responding? And what you see is an increase in rooting depth in the 50% treatment relative to the full irrigation. Again, this is full irrigation based on a farmer's recommendation. If you're managing irrigation by ET, actually the farmers in our region never meet ET anyway, so all irrigation is deficit irrigation unless it rains. But you see a greater rooting depth, and you see more lateral root growth, and that persists throughout the season. And so then we ask again how these treatments affect the physiological response. So if we apply this early season deficit, do we see an acclimation response in physiology? And just briefly, what you'll see here is this is the photosynthetic response over the course of that week in that same center pivot. And this blue line represents our well-watered treatment. What you see from all plots, this is day zero, so this is just before they're watered, a positive response to irrigation, and then midweek you see a decline. And where you see this maintenance of photosynthesis are in our early season deficits. So these plants had larger root systems, they maintained photosynthesis later into the week, and they showed an increase in pod maturity. Not necessarily an increase in yield, but an increase in maturity, which is an issue. And we see that with water, instantaneous water use efficiency as well. So based on those observations from the field, and again, predicted environments of crop management or water management, we asked, okay, we're interested in this acclimation ability or the acclimation capacity of plants. What sort of diversity is present in peanut germplasm? So we took a step back and went back and screened a large collection of germplasm, and these are meaningless to anybody that everyone that's not working on peanut. But we looked at narrowed this thing down to a couple of hundred genotypes, screened these in the field and in greenhouse conditions and under a variety of stresses, salt, heat, high temperature, low temperature, and looked for visual phenotypes, looked for physiological phenotypes as well, and identified a fairly large range of contrasting phenotypes. And it was at that point that we said, so we looked at emergence, photosynthetic response, and we looked at yield. We looked at not just yield, but we looked at harvest index. We looked at biomass accretion, again, in the field. And it was at this point that we then said, okay, let's take contrasting phenotypes, look at their acclimation capacity, and then ask, how do these differ on a transcript level, on a protein level, and on a metabolome level? And that's been sort of our approach. So in terms of the acclimation capacity, this is an example of two of the genotypes where one we called I hesitate to call it sensitive and tolerant, but for lack of a better term, a sensitive line, which is 166. That's the open circles here. This is the photosynthetic response to thermal stress. A sensitive line and a tolerant line, and we said, okay, we see this contrasting response in the field. We get these under controlled conditions. Can we induce acclimation? Can we make the sensitive line respond similar to the tolerant line? Again, this is sort of very 1960s plant physiology, but indeed, that's what we see. So here's the beginning of our stress control conditions. The dashed lines are non-acclimated plants. The solid lines are acclimated plants. And what you'll see is in the short term, if I can move this pointer, we have our putative sensitive lines that have gone through an acclimation are maintaining their rate of photosynthesis you know, a couple of days into the stress. Eventually, they start to decline. And if you leave these under these high temperature conditions, again, this is in a controlled chamber, you actually start to see recovery. And again, that's associated with an acclimation response. And so we're interested in looking at, on a transcript, proteome, and metabolome level, now what are the differences between acclimated and non-acclimated plants? What are the differences between tolerant and sensitive lines? And so we do lots of arrays, lots of 2D proteomics, and plug things into, MapMan and identify candidate pathways and candidate genes. And then at this point, now we take sort of an old school molecular biology approach where we look at single gene events and then, you know, we make crosses and stack genes and things like that. I'm going to skip through a couple of these. And so in the end, we start to build back these pathways and make predictions about what's going on based on our metabolite data and go in and confirm, yes, we're getting changes in simple sugars. Yes, we're getting changes in epicuticular waxes. And we build these nice sort of cartoon-like models. So that's all well and good. But without picking on anyone but myself, we've taken that approach before. My biggest fear is not that we can't identify lots of interesting pathways and lots of important genes. But to date, our successes have been limited. So maybe this is sort of the opposite of what Maria wanted me to show. We see nice, interesting phenotypes. We've done lots of interesting, or interesting to me anyway, lots of interesting physiology, especially in controlled environments. But as most people will tell you, once you move into the field, again, the constraints of the environmental constraints associated with the field, the amount of variability, the extremes you see in the field, oftentimes the phenotypes we measure under controlled conditions aren't manifest in the field. Our conclusion was there are a lot of papers in there about reactive oxygen scavenging. Every meeting you go to about molecular responses to stress or to sneezing or somebody wearing an ugly sweater, you see an upregulation of reactive oxygen scavengers. The conclusion of this work, or my conclusion, is it's not that, and there's been lots of work on overexpressing every gene in the ROI pathway. None of that's on the marketplace that we know of anyway. The conclusion is not that that pathway is not important. It's that it's so important that you can manipulate that pathway all you want, but there are biological limitations to what the plant is going to allow you to do. So you can jack up different enzyme activities really high. Now, we do know if you knock a lot of those things out, they're seedling lethal. So that speaks to the importance of the pathway. So my fear as someone pursuing transgenic approaches to stress tolerance is how many of the really important things are we identifying? How many of the stories are going to be like ROI scavenging? Well, some of them are actually positive. So this is some work that I've done with Randy Allen, and this was one that I think was turning out, we thought maybe was a little bit negative, but actually I think has some promise. So here we've overexpressed some of the DREV genes, CBF3 and ABF3, one of them constitutively and one of them under a regulated promoter. So goes back to some of the work that Thomas Jha and Shinazaki had showed, that if you overexpress things, if you manipulate ABA or you manipulate a lot of actually stress-responsive genes, one of the phenotypes is stunted growth. So you get these plants that are incredibly water-use efficient, but they grow slower. They close their stomates down, they don't use much water, and they just grow slower. So we sort of knew that would happen with constitutive expression, and this is just to show this is constitutive expression of ABF3, and you see these stunted plants. A little more normal growth with a regulated promoter. We use the APX promoter from P, and then this is a Czech variety, and then this is our wild-type background. So we do these experiments in the glass house. The plants are stunted. They look awful. They take 250 days to flower, which is about 100 days too long for cotton. And of course, it's due to closed stomates. You get this big decrease in photosynthetic activity, and that is correlated with a, you know, decrease in stomatal conductance. So we had this bright idea. We'd done some work on looking at gene expression and some different cotton lines and said, oh, well, they're probably upregulating all these stress genes. So we compared the ABF and CBF plants to some stressed Czech varieties we had, and I'm not going to go into that. This is the interesting thing. So we grew these in the field this year in Lubbock basically for a seed increase. And again, remember, you could, the plants in the greenhouse, there was a dramatic difference between constitutive overexpression of ABF3 compared to wild type. In the field this year, again, 6 millimeters worth of water. These are irrigated, so they've obviously received more than 6 millimeters of water. At 90 days in the season, here's the transgenic line. Here's wild type. Here's under full irrigation. This is actually at 110 days in the season. You can't distinguish these plants from wild type. We went in. These are homozygous lines. They're all expressors. Here's our CBF3 next to wild type. Flowering time is identical. Leaf area is identical. Photosynthetic rate is actually a little repressed in the constitutive ABF plants, and conductance is also a little bit down. So we just harvested these plants. I don't have the yield data, and I certainly don't have the biomass data yet. And again, this was under irrigated conditions in a very extreme year. But this was a case where under production conditions in an extreme environment, the potentially downside of closed stomates, either the system was overwhelmed, the regulatory mechanism was overwhelmed or circumvented, that these plants grew essentially normally. So we're fairly excited about this pathway. So I'm going to skip through this since it's time to go and just give, again, maybe a few more words of wisdom. So one big effort in my lab, again, is crop production. The other thing is stress management. So we have a large effort with James Mahan's lab in monitoring stress, developing technology, looking at canopy temperatures, looking at whole canopy and whole field responses, using remote sensing to irrigation and building those into models for irrigation application. My interest is in screening germplasm. How are these plants responding in real time over the course of a season in real world production scenarios? So in terms of the future of transgenics or the future of crop improvement, of course, the foundation of that is germplasm improvement. It has to be. We haven't reached our limits in terms of our ability to improve things by management, but it's about identifying the stress, being able to actually quantify the stress in your production environment, and then, of course, managing that stress. And the management either comes from crop management schemes or it's going to come from germplasm. And again, in my opinion, these things have to be rooted, pun intended, in the field under relevant production conditions. So I actually have to show that my lab does generate data, since I didn't actually show any real data. Two talks, a former postdoc from my lab, Rao Kotapalli, is giving a talk tomorrow on integrating the transcript, metabolome, and proteome data. And then I have a graduate student that's working on winter hardiness in safflower and oilseed crops, Zach Hines, and he's giving a talk on Wednesday. So, thanks.